This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a GHIL joint lecture in cooperation with the IHR's Modern German History Seminar, held by Philip Gussert, Chair for Contemporary History at the University of Mannheim. His talk is entitled Contesting Political Spaces, Thoughts on a World History of Street Protest. Even though we now live in an age of digital media, physical street protest is not a thing of the past. Anyone knows that even in the 21st century, public, symbolically charged spaces continue to be occupied by protesters who hope to score political points. We may even be under the impression that the frequency of street protests has increased. So why does taking to the streets still work, even though we can be so wonderfully outraged online today? The obvious answer is, it can be explained historically. Philip Gussert's lecture draws on examples from 250 years of history, covering a wide range of societies, issues, and geographical entities, in order to present preliminary findings on an ongoing project about a world history of street protest.
Well, thank you for the nice introduction and for the welcome, and I'm glad to be here again. And I think the last time I came here, and I have to say this, I didn't have to think very hard before I left that I had to bring my passport. So I told me several times myself, and you don't forget your passport because they will turn you around at the border. Yeah, it's thoughts on a world history. So it's a work in progress that I'm talking about. It's a project I have been engaged in for a couple of years. It builds on my expertise on German protest history, on anti-nuclear global or transatlantic protest movements during the Cold War. And at some point, I decided I wanted to go into a larger geographical but also chronological frame. And my story tonight begins on a warm summer's day on August 23, to be precise, of the year 1841, in the port city of Caen in the département Calvados in Normandy in France. François Guizot, French foreign minister and deputy for Calvados in the National Assembly, is in town for consultations with a local council. Yet the reception for France's leading politician are anything but friendly. The liberal grand bourgeois, an eminent historian, by the way, had alienated parts of the French public because he is adamant in preventing an extension of the franchise in France, but also he is blocking reforms in general, and he is in favor of a Franco-British rapprochement when it comes to international relations. So, days before Guizot is arriving in Caen, the word has been given out among his enemies that the great man should be given a proper welcome with a charivari, or a round of rough music, as contemporaneous English would have called it. And at 9 o'clock in the evening night of August 23rd, 1841, as the members of the local elite are assembling in the beautiful building of the local council in honor of Guizot, numerous people are gathering outside on the square in front of the prefecture, singing the Marseillaise and the old revolutionary song Ça ira. Shouts ring out, Abat Guizot, Guizot à la potence, down with Guizot, Guizot to the gallows. And the dissonant serenade continues in the streets of the Norman city on the following nights. Guizot was never to rest during his stay in Caen. During the July Revolution of the 1830s and the 1840s, it was not unusual that politicians were greeted with a round of rough music as they were traveling into the provinces of France. So charivaris were a popular medium of protest under a regime the Forbade Street demonstrations. Here, a traditional form was politicized as a substitute for other ways of expressing political dissent. Previously, charivaris had served as a way to denounce a violation of communal values, especially sexual morality, such when a widowed older woman married a much younger man. Then an infernal concert was performed in front of the sinner's house using improvised musical instruments, pans, pots, rattles, bells, and whistles. But since the 1815 restoration, these traditional customs all over pre-March Europe, including Bavaria and Prussia and other parts where the Rhenish carnival was similarly politicized in a clandestine manner, now they begin to convey dissident attitudes. So what is new is not the form, but the place of performance and the meaning of an old form. In Caen in 1841, the charivari was not performed in front of a private house, but in front of the prefecture, the seat of local government. And during the July monarchy, elected officials, ministers, deputies, of local officials, as well as priests and bishops, were repeatedly confronted with variations of such a spectacle. Thus, the charivari served as a method of articulating political dissent in a system and at a time during which the right of assembly was severely restricted, and oppositionists fell for numerous ideas to politicize seemingly harmless social functions such as funerals or banquets. When freedom of assembly was reintroduced in France in 1868, such charivaris, but also funeral processions, quickly lost their political importance. Now dissidents could again be communicated in a modern way by means of street demonstrations, for example. Well, this is not the end of the story. During the COVID-19 pandemic, and more recently during the conflict in France over pension reform, French politicians were often confronted with modernized forms of such noisy spectacles, including pot concerts or caserolades, as you can see here in these images from last year. They're actually from last year, from 23, when Elizabeth Borne was still prime minister, and as she was traveling provincial French places and towns, people would gather in the squares and they would, you know, perform these noisy concerts. And I really like the poster here. Justice nulle part, casserole partout. Also, no justice, no equality. When you have no justice, you will have casserolades everywhere in France. And this is what happened during those days of the spring of 23. So the form that had lost its significance at the end of the 19th century, as I already mentioned, had not really disappeared completely in Francophone countries. It continued to serve as a medium of resistance in colonial Africa, in French-speaking colonial Africa. And during the 1970s, the casserolade was imported to Chile as cacerolazo during the Pinochet dictatorship. And in 2001, a massive casserolazo brought down or helped to bring down, overthrow a government in Argentina. So this set piece of street protest is, of course, a wonderful example for a global history of street protest that I'm attempting to write. The repertoire of protest history is very diverse. It circulates across times, countries, and continents. But something like that is an ideal object of study. If a form such as the casserolade seems to easily transcend cultural and historical boundaries, then it is a good example for a world history of street protests and too good to ignore. And here is what I will do today. I will present you my main research questions for the work in progress, the project that I'm involved in. I will make an argument about the uses of history for understanding protest that also tries to engage social science people who are looking at protest and studying it with their methods. I'll have a little theory part there, and then I'll get you to the present situation and ask why it continues to matter in the present. The point of my study is to show how from the late 18th century, you have already mentioned it, street protest as a medium for articulating political and social discontent developed over a good 250 years. I start with the Middle Qing dynasty in China and the transatlantic age of revolutions. It goes through the Jacksonian period, the years around 1848, the Indian Revolt of 1859, to what happens every week in London, Paris, Delhi, Washington. Public protest is everyday life in the world, and in liberal democracies, it has lost the smell of the radical and the subversive. It seems to have become normality, but we'll discuss that in a moment. So here is my research questions, the one I have already read. And secondly, I am asking whether there is a universal body language of protest, whether that is something that transcends time and culture, and what within such a context is passed on and what is not, what disappears, and how does what has been handed down adapt to changing conditions, and I have already given you an example for that. I think there is a point to be made or a question to be asked why it does not disappear from the world today. We can so easily enrage ourselves and be outraged online, nightly, you know, no borders there. Why do we still need those resistant bodies in the streets? Aren't they obsolete? Why are we still doing this? And here comes my proud historical point. Of course, it's historical. It can be explained historically. And there is a historical reason why these activities continue to be in the street. So it seems to be a simple question, but I think it's a question that needs to be asked. So street protest is historical, and it is historical in a dual sense. The repertoire itself, of course, is the result of a historical process, how we march. You know, it's not just there. It came about, it developed over centuries. But also the society that is observing, the people who are standing around, perceive something as an act of political resistance or social dissent, as an act of protest, because they have become used to it, to qualify it, to perceive it, to see it in such a way. The overall goals of my studies are presenting a narrative that goes beyond single national stories that I have done that for Germany post 45. So I want to do something that goes beyond a certain set of national or cultural regional histories and, write a synthesis. And there is a good reason for that, because it has not been attempted yet. So that's quite simple. No one has attempted it, really. And that's why I'm not yet ready with the book, because there is much that I can build on, and we can discuss that later. But such a synthesis has not really been tried. Now, I also have I want to make an argument for world history in a situation where we talk a lot about disconnections, rightfully. Yes, I started, with the passport problem, but I still think, also because of the way we connect each other medially, that we need to continue to write world or global history, and we can talk about these terms, but in a sense, write a historical synthesis and analysis that goes beyond the nation state, definitely, but also goes beyond the big cultural regions of the world. And finally, I, having talked about protest in a more specific German context quite a bit, I really think that there is something that goes for the historical perspective. We need to make ourselves heard as historians when we are competing for attention, and we shouldn't really leave the field to other social sciences and disciplines. And I think there is an importance of the historical viewpoint in our current debates about protests as a way of political communication. Now, I will not really bore you with my very big concept of the various aspects of the repertoire, but the point that I'm giving down here, the criteria that I'm using to characterize, to define, you know, those various forms of action, the repertoire in its various subforms, is really by the use of body and movement in space and time. So space, time, and duration, how long are these bodies in the streets, you know, how do they move, and these kind of things. That is my main criterion to come up with different categories of street protest. I talk about violence in a moment, but it's not the distinguishing criterion for my project. Here's the German version of that. And since we are the German History Research Seminar, I felt that I could give you the German version too, but it's way too much for you to read, but we can come back later. But here you see, you know, how I'm ordering according to these three dimensions of street protest. If the repertoire has been handed down historically, it can be assumed that there will be transfer effects and exchanges across borders. It's, of course, always demonstrated by a personality such as Gandhi, who pioneered a certain version of a street protest in a British imperial context in South Africa. As you know, of course, Gandhi is often being used because he seems to fit the Western way of going about the history of protest and dissent in the street. Confucian China is less easy to integrate in our common narrative, and I'll get back to that later. It is, of course, not easy to write a non-Eurocentric history of street protest because protest as part of the democratic narrative is so closely linked to Western ideas of progress, which in turn had an impact outside Europe. In Europe, people grow up with images of revolutionary and disruptive change, standing in the shadow of the revolutionary narrative. And I found it very interesting that one of the speakers of Letzte Generation, these are the people who clue themselves to the street, who actually borrowed what they were doing from some people here in Britain. So he, in an interview, made this point, you know, that we need a peaceful revolution. Of course, that also refers to the GDR, to the end of the GDR, but it's one of these indications that people have this revolutionary narrative in their mind when they go out into the streets. That's why I also juxtapose the liberal success story, so to say, in quotation marks, with a history of violence in street protests. And coming back to the July monarchy, it is obvious that there was a lot of violence in that political space in that country. So people did not only express their dissent ritually and playfully, as we have seen in the opening example, but they revolted violently, while the state power for its part engaged in conflict management with bayonets. And I find it interesting that we live in such a strange amnesia toward the history of violent protest in Europe and externalize it as a problem of others. And here we have another, which would be Saint-Domingue, Haiti, in 1791, which happens at the time of the French Revolution. And when you look at history books or how, you know, people write about this, Saint-Domingue, Haiti is called a slave uprising or a revolt, whereas the Journées of the Sans-Culottes, which you see on the right side in 1792, are part of a revolution, right? That's how we have become used to talk about it, you know? And we do not give the honorary title, or did not give until very recently. It has now changed to Haiti, the honorary title of revolution, whereas we give it to the French Jacobins, of course. That brings me to my second part, the uses of history. And here we must now counter it with a question of continuity and change. A cartoon also published last year in The Economist in reaction to what was happening in France draws a line of continuity across the centuries, but that conceals the essential differences that I was already mentioning with regard to the casserolade. So the question is, for a historian, how that set piece, the casserolade, how that from a diverse repertoire changes its position, meaning, and function when being related to new contexts. And I have already made that point. So when members of an NGO such as Attack or the Yellow Vests bang on pots and pans with wooden spoons today in order to heat up their president and to reassure themselves of their own resistance, that is not an independent form compared to the historical model. The rattling taps into the toolkits of the July monarchy. It plays with the memory of the instability of a regime that was swept away in February 1848 along the lines of Emmanuel Macron. Remember Louis Philippe. But the casserolade today is not the protest in itself. In 1841, it was the protest. It was the way, you know, to express dissent in a situation where you could not have posters, banners, chants, and so on, where you were more limited by law in how you could express your dissent in the streets. Today, the casserole is just one element among several to generate media attention in often original and interesting ways. So this position of the casserolade has changed within the street protest action. So with the change in media and society, it has taken on a different meaning and is no longer aimed at specific perpetrators and a local audience, as we had observed in 1841. Instead, it is trimmed to current visual codes that we understand. So continuity of a form, but change of function and meaning of the chosen means the casserolade in that sense, in that example. Now, in 24, of course, we are no longer in a situation of street political illegality with regard to charivaris, and we also have to account for that. Anyone and everyone is allowed to assemble peacefully and without weapons under the usual conditions of right of assembly. In 1841, the very charivari was a criminal act, and the responsible magistrate initiated an investigation. This is why we know something about what happened in August of 1841. The riot was reported and has therefore been handed down as a source. Street protest as a medium for articulating dissatisfaction, an embodied expression of social dissent, I'll come to definition in the moment, may be similar across time and continents, but its effects are decisively determined by the political framework, whether you have an unfree system like in 1830s France, 1840s France, or liberal democracy. So in 1841, it was a risky maneuver. In 23, it was not. Protest movements themselves love to draw continuity lines and to imagine themselves of being part of a tradition. We can think of the women's movement, the labor movement in Germany. These days, it's quite fashionable to go back to the 1848 revolution. Now, as I said, we underestimate how deficient in today's terms state conflict management was at the time. And even liberal historians like Guizot, and he could have been one of us, did not shy away from the use of violence. Protest rituals rightly attract a lot of attention in research, but they downplay the extreme violence in the age of revolutions. The Orleanist regime had thousands of deaths on its conscience due to the military suppression of protests and brought 150,000 criminal proceedings against acts of protest to the courts, which resulted in 110,000 convictions over the duration of its 18 years. Now, it sounds funny to imagine Macron as the new Louis Philippe
who is swept away by a new 48 revolution, but I think it ignores the historical reality that conflicts over street politics were routinely solved with violence, as we have seen, and continue to be solved with violence well into the 60s in European countries and sometimes today, as you all know. Now, I don't want to break the baton over the July monarchy because that would be unhistorical. But I want to point out that the civilizing of street protests, which I think is some of my central arguments in my study, is a great and hard-won democratic achievement. And here we come to the current times. But I want to say that we cannot take it for granted, as we have seen in recent years. And this is why theories of civil disobedience that focus on nonviolence are so important in liberal democracies. It was the workers' and the women's movements that systematically tried to break the cycle of violence and civilize the street demonstrations in, yes, at the beginning, a very masculine way. They did this in order to refute the accusation that the mob was taking over the streets. And here comes my example from German history, the disciplined army of the demonstrators, the suffrage marches in Prussia in the early 20th century. And as you see, these men are in their Sunday best. And as they walk along the streets, they keep the streetcar tracks clear and make sure that they don't give any pretext for the police to intervene. The same can be said about Gandhi and Mandela in South Africa, who try to prove themselves worthy by advocating peaceful protest. We can look at the women's movement that also really try to present that worthiness to the outside world. The relevant insight here is that from the current perspective, we are living in a, if you look at it historically, exceptional age, because the violence is delegitimized, you know. But that's not the historical, how would I say that? That is not what historically was seen as the normal situation. So I want to highlight that point in particular. But of course, we also know, and I'm giving you two examples from Germany and the United States, that violence is very much around. I would not show you an image of a Black Lives Matter demonstration here, but it is clear if you are African American and you live in rural Missouri, it is probably it is very difficult to realize your right to assemble. In Germany, in recent years, it was very interesting to see that young people who glued themselves on the street in a climate protest were treated like subversives or criminal clans. They were not seeking regime change, and they were also not a mafia group. They were calling for the fulfillment of a parliamentary resolution, whatever one may think of the wisdom of our climate laws and the jurisprudence of our constitutional court. But they were treated like potential terrorists. Now comes my bit of history again, because I'm now in the third chapter of my talk on the uses of history, because street blockages are actually not that new. The peace movement of the 1980s in Germany knew them. At the time, there were also many criminal proceedings brought against blockers of the 1980s. What is also interesting that if you look at German protest history, you find many blockades of roads by lorry drivers, like here an example from 1983. So this more or less happens at the same time, and you guess who goes before a court and who does not. And that history, of course, repeated itself in Germany in the January of 2024, when farmers that were blockading streets were not brought criminal proceedings against whereas the letzte Generation. Some of them went into prison. But it's good always, you know, to look at the story that it has a tradition. And that brings me to another important part of protest history, and that is the constitutional, the legal frame that we have to look at. Now, in Germany, what is so interesting that we saw a liberalization of demonstration law during the 1990s, and it is often being discussed in the context of two famous Mutlangen decisions of the Federal Constitutional Court. You know, can address that in the discussion. But there was a reversal of a more liberal acceptance of blockages by the court after 2011. And so these blockages remain illegal within a certain context. But as I said, the law is not applied equally to everyone. And we could think about similar examples from other countries, of course. So yes, protests, violent revolts have not really disappeared from the world on the one hand, while on the other hand, that liberal narrative seems to be very strong, at least in the German tradition or the Western European tradition, so strong that sometimes heads of states and heads of government, that photo actually is quite interesting historically, that heads of government and heads of state protest themselves. You know, they create a protest demonstration. Die inszenieren das. I'm losing my English words here. I'm sorry. They are inscenating it in a way as if they were protesting against terrorists. And yes, Rahul Gandhi, of course, also saw marching as something that could bring back the esteem of his country as he was preparing for the recent elections in India. We also should know, and I'm just throwing this in, that it's politically ambivalent. So also in my book on German protest history, of course, I bring in the right-wingers. You know, they also use this means of expressing their dissent. And of course, it also is very much something that involves many generations these days. Now let's jump to the theory part very quickly. I follow Judith Butler. I define street protest as an embodied action. I see protest basically as a way to express a political opinion in a very particular way. And I want to stress the point that street protest has a special function because performatively it goes beyond what is communicated in writing and verbally. That's why I call it a nonverbal pre-linguistic discourse. I'm sorry you cannot see it right now because the Zoom thing is there. So that is important to make, this distinction that assemblies and street protests have a special function, that they follow a different logic of interaction, and they are different from what is communicated in writing and verbally. Also, you see that, I think, very clear in those nonverbal forms of the street protest repertoire. They don't require any placards and banners like the vigil that were organized here, two examples from Germany again, after racist attacks in the early 1990s, or the example from the peace movement here on the right side. And that's the reason why all liberal constitutions make that distinction since the age of revolution, that you have two separate rights to free speech, of course, but then also the right to assemble peacefully and without arms in the open airs. Now, the embodiment is also the answer why protest still requires concrete physical spaces, that question that I was asking in the beginning. Because it is not the same as free speech. It is not the same as writing something online or organizing an online petition because the bodies have a different meaning and speak a different language. And that's why it did not disappear even with a generation like the Fridays of Future, which is like the incarnation of a digital youth. They also resorted to the means of demonstration to give their cause visibility and media reach. They filmed and posted incessantly from the demonstration, but this appearance on the streets was necessary because it mobilized the established media and the established politics. So these bodies send not only a different message, they also have a different impact on those they want to reach. So even in the digital age, dissenting counter-publicity is created through mass physical presence in specific places. And that has always been the case. So we have seen various media revolutions during the 20th century, and yes, the civil rights movement, but also the 68 movements were pioneers for the television period, and then came Occupy in the early 21st century, who brought the story up to social media and also innovated street politics by connecting it for social media in a way which had not been done before. Some forms have disappeared because the media ensemble has changed. The long distance marches are out of fashion. They still happen sometimes, but they are now a minority phenomenon. They are not very often done. They were efficient as long as you had a print media system with many local newspapers, because then marching long distances across America, as here in this example, for example, really brought the story to various local communities. But there's another point that we need to make when it comes to why protest still requires specific physical spaces, and that is not only the outside impact, but the internal reference frame, how community, how a group, how identity is created through taking part in a protest demonstration. We can adapt it freely from Descartes and say, I protest, therefore I am. So protest has this expressive dimension, which is a term from social science research, in contrast to the instrumental dimension, which concerns the goals that are expressed by a demonstration. And this expressive dimension is often more important for individual participants as they take part in such events. And these emotional effects are, of course, very important and are very strong if you are in a camp like here on Tahrir Square in 2011. Final point, back to history. Past protest activities shape and define present actions. Here we have a German tradition on display, but we do this and we continue to do this as societies, as activists, because it has been done before. So we do it based on tradition and experience. We all distinguish between political, social protest and leisure activities. Sometimes it's not easy to separate the two, see the love parade or a festival like Woodstock. But outsiders and spectators, as well as activists themselves, see it as something that has always been done in a certain way. And that's why they continue to do it in a certain way with, you know, street protests and demonstrations. And here comes my little China history point, because in China, it is often done very differently in a way that we would not recognize as a protest demonstration. And that it's the ritual kneeling in front of the police. And it actually goes back to the 18th century, to the Middle Qing period, which is the period in which I will start my book. So that for European or American observers is mostly incomprehensible what is happening. And here we have an example from Tiananmen, 1989, where you see the loyal filialist protest tradition that comes from Confucianism and has lived on for 200 years in China. But we see that in, you know, in our lectures and in our school books. That, of course, refers to Cold War struggles, Prague 68, Berlin 1953, and so on. The tank men. And that is, so the left side, you know, we would really be hard-pressed to explain what is happening. But on the right side, that image is recognizable for most European observers. So let me come to my conclusion. The modern protest repertoire has been handed down. Earlier protests, street protests, events shape what we understand by protest today. Secondly, street protest is efficient. Embodiment has strong medial communication effects which reinforce the message beyond speech. So the physical gathering of bodies in the streets has this non-verbal function and meaning that communicates a message beyond what is said and written at the same time. There is, as I mentioned, the internal expressive effect, the identity part of the story that is very important for those who are taking part in street protests. I would like to again stress that old forms don't die, but their regulation by state violence and other forms of state regulation does not disappear either. And finally, despite several waves of democratization that we have experienced since the 70s and the 1980s, I would say when we look at the history of street protests, Western Europeans live in an exceptional situation in which the idea of the right of assembly is theoretically almost universally realized. In practice, as I said, there is a high propensity for violence against protesters in the streets, and they cannot always redeem their right of assembly. But the liberal protest tradition as a norm is the one that we are holding up. But I would say in historical terms, it is a very exceptional position that we are in. The civilizing of street protests as well as the civil handling of protesters has been hard won. This is why liberal Europe is, as I say, currently and historically in an exceptional situation. So now with this final thought, I can thank you for your attention and we can now have a discussion. And that's, of course, my university, Mannheim, where you find a few of climate activists assembled in front of our famous palace, which is the seat of the university. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.